Ko Hikaroro te mauka, ko Waikawaiti te awa, ko Arai Turu, ko Taki te mu ka waka, ko Kaitahu te iwi, ko Kati Huirapa te hapū, ko Puki te raki te marae, ko Emma Hislop tuku ikua. Welcome to Circuit Cast. My name is Emma Hislop, and today I'm delighted to be talking to Tanya Roka about Rematriation, a program of five films that are currently touring venues in Aotearoa. Rematriation is commissioned by Circuit and curated by Tanya in her new role as Circuit's Kaitiaki Kiriata. The program features works by Tia Barrett, Bobby Luke, Sandy Wakefield, Kerry Mazur Grabalna, and Tanya, and is broadly themed around the idea of wahine knowledge. Throughout Rematriation, the program showcases a variety of styles and approaches, from dance to animation to drama. Tanya is here this morning to tell us about the program, the artists, and her wider practice. Kia ora, Tanya.
Kia ora, Emma.
Nice to have you. I wondered if you could introduce yourself to our listeners.
Yes, absolutely. Ko Tanya te rorangi te miringa ruka aho. Ko Ngāti Pako Napuhi te iwi. I guess I could introduce myself as the Kaitiaki Kiriata. I have several roles, but I've been a part of the Circuit group for quite a few years now and very happy to be there. Circuit has always been really integral in keeping my work going, I guess, as a space to show works and video works. So yeah, I'm always happy to support that work.
Could you tell us a little bit more about the theme, Rematriation? Who coined the term and what does it mean to you?
Yes, well, I had to double check who coined the term rematriation. I've sort of heard it along the kind of airwaves with my work with Native Land Digital. It's the online mapping the territories of Indigenous peoples and a website that you can see that is kind of more well-known in the US, Turtle Island, Canada, but I'm the executive director. So a lot of our work has been talking about what it means to be Indigenous, land, territory, ownership, stewardship, all these kind of words that have so much meaning right now. And rematriation kind of filtered into my thoughts from just tracking around and looking at tribal nations and seeing what they're doing so as we can build out the map more and show more about the work that Indigenous peoples are doing when it comes to reclaiming their lands and their languages and their cultural heritage. And so when I looked into it a bit further, I could see that it was first introduced by a Native feminist book by Lee Miracle from the Solo Nation. She's well known as an Indigenous feminist, and I think it was around 1988 when the book was published, I think. Need to double check on that one. But yeah, just as looking and finding these things on websites and finding the work that other Indigenous nations are doing, it was sort of clicking over in my mind. I've been working with our Grandmothers Council now for about 20 odd years. And, you know, I'm like, yeah, this is stuff that we've been doing, you know, all along, trying to reclaim the language, trying to reclaim, you know, some sort of authority over our maunga, you know, what's happening in our tribal nations, our polluted rivers. And the Grandmothers Council have been working with contemporary claims to try and protect some of our rivers and protect some of our ancestral maunga that are being mined. You know, when they speak about these things, they sort of talk about them as mountains that have been beheaded by mining work. And, you know, there's a lot of trauma attached to anything that's kind of land-based or orientated. And a lot of us find comfort in our grandmothers and in their knowledge. And so I think that's what was so important about this, is that comfort when you're in trauma. Yeah.
Thank you. That's so insightful. And I, of course, repatriation has been a term that we've, you know, most people are probably familiar with, but rematriation, I mean, I looked it up too, and I love the history of that and who coined the term and that it was a feminist. And yeah, I actually did some research into my own iwi, Ngāi Tahu's digital land mapping, and fairly recently, and I was amazed at how much work has been done. And yeah, there's so much I don't know, you know, always learning.
Me too.
So the program features moving image work by Tia Barrett, Bobby Luke, Sandy Wakefield, Kerry Mae Zagrobalna, and yourself. I just wanted to ask why these particular artists and works.
I was looking through the work, and of course, you come to notice the commonalities that are sort of filtering through the work, and all of them, you know, are speaking to the land. All of them have such important messages, you know, when you're thinking of that kind of comfort, grandmother comfort. I mean, literally it comes out in Bobby Luke's work, talking to his mum, and you see the moko there as well. And it was just really important because also our Mother Earth, our Papatūānuku, is another grandmother where we can seek comfort. And I think that's really important, especially with my work looking at territories and, you know, these troublesome ideas of territory and ownership in our lands and how we thought of these things as guardians rather than owners. But then in another sense of the word, we have to kind of start thinking of ourselves as owners of lands in order to have some form of say, especially right now with what's happening. So yeah, just thinking through these things. I mean, there are no answers, but it's really good to be talking about these things. And the work, I think, speaks to that. You know, there's with Mātauranga Māori, there's almost always, there's so many more layers that aren't said with what you're looking at. And I think all of those works kind of speak to something in our minds that connect us to all those kind of questions and all those things that we're looking for.
Absolutely. And te taiao is so prevalent in all of them. That's something that really struck me and sort of bound them tightly together, even though they're all so different. I was very taken with Bobby Luke's moving image work. It's shot on Super 8, I think, and that's very nostalgic for me because my dad used to make a lot of movies on Super 8, and I'm sure a lot of people have the same kind of nostalgic vibe. But I just wondered how you came across, how did you discover Bobby Luke as an artist?
I think, well, we worked together. So I was aware of Bobby's practice, you know, as a designer. So I was really, when I saw the film work that was also attached to his latest fashion work with Fashion Week, as soon as I heard that little conversation with him and his mum, you know, just those little conversations are so important. And I've learned that with our grandmother's council as well. There are so many conversations I wish, even though it's intrusive to record something like that, I really wish in some way I would have recorded these conversations with them because so often, you know, they pass and you don't know when you're going to lose someone.
Exactly.
Yeah, and just seeing that film work, it sort of made me think of my grandmother and how I wish that, you know, I'd have been on this track of doing these artistic things when she was still alive, because I just feel like all of those things are lost. And for me, with Bobby's work, one of the brilliant memories I have of my grandmother is saying to me when I was a teenager, "Aren't you cold?" Because I had sort of a singlet on and shorts. And I said, no, Nana, I'm feeling quite warm. And she said, "Oh, what it is to be young." She said, "Looking at you now, I can remember being in my panikotis, my petticoats, riding my horse across the field, and there was nothing like it. I just felt so free." And, you know, that's just a beautiful memory I have of her. And when I was looking at Bobby's work, the film work, I just was reminded of that, of her conversation about being free in her panikotis, riding her horse.
it felt very emotional, that piece, for me. I watched it numerous times and I kept coming back to it. And it reminds me too of I wish the same about my grandfather. You know, I wish he was here to talk to now. And yeah, I mean, Dad's still around, which is great. And Dad, you know, knows a lot of stuff, but it's just having the opportunity to sit down over a cup of tea and really kind of look back.
And chat.
Yeah. Let's talk about Carrie May's work for a moment. Does she have much of a background in moving image? I think I knew of her as a jeweller predominantly.
I first saw her work on the Courtney Place light boxes.
Oh, yeah.
And I was just mesmerized by those images.
Mm-hmm.
Just such beautiful work. So when Mark showed me this work,
mm-hmm.
I was like, oh, yes.
Yes. That's really extraordinary.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really beautiful. And I love it because it shows that kind of movement and grace and kind of connection and it just speaks to all the things, you know, that we're kind of talking about, but that's being spoken through the body.
Absolutely.
And I'm not one of those ones who is very, you know, body orientated. You know, but our songs and our dances, kind of the data holding mechanisms. So even though some of us may not be able to express it in that form, it kind of runs in our DNA. And so it's really beautiful to watch, and you can feel it, even if, you know, the movements are foreign to you in your own body, you really feel that connector watching those movements and things as well. So
no, yeah. It was just phenomenal. I actually looked up the dancer on YouTube afterwards and was just, yeah, blown away. Just such a beautiful piece of work. I just wanted to talk about your practice for a moment and how you would perhaps define your own artistic practice.
It has evolved, really. It first started as a kind of hidden secret painting practice.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, I just woke up and one morning, and I think I was around 20s or something. My youngest was still fairly young at this time, and I had had a dream. Dream. And I'd never been artistic or allowed to take up any kind of artistic kind of hobbies or take it in school or anything. So I was kind of mystified, and I ended up in the warehouse and I bought a cheap canvas and some paints, didn't know what to do with them, and then tried to express this dream that I had had. And then once I started that, quite a few followed afterwards, and I didn't know what was happening, but it was like a compulsion to get these things out. And of course, when you look at them, they're really sort of, you know, art critics would say, oh, that's very naive, you know, just color straight out of the tube, squashed on the canvas sort of thing. But,
yeah,
you know, yeah, it was just pushed to create. And then it wasn't until a few years later that my auntie discovered them, and she said, oh, these are full of wairua. You need to follow this. You need to do something about it. And then I started along the seeking education and formalized education to try and find out what this journey was that I was on.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. I love hearing about how people start on their creative practice, you know, because often I feel like it is just like a little kernel of something that is sort of nagging at you and won't kind of quieten down. And I often think that that's our tipuna maybe, you know.
Yes.
Yeah. Like me and many Māori, you didn't grow up on your home whenua?
Nope.
Can you talk a bit about the part, if any, that this has played in your work?
It's a huge part because I didn't grow up there. We came back when I think I was about 11. So we went back to our tribal lands around about 11. So huge learning curve. I had grown up just outside of London. Culture shock. You know, we came into what a lot of our communities are going through right now that I hadn't seen before. And because I didn't have that, you know, sort of background of growing up there, I didn't understand what was happening. Mm-hmm. So for me, there was a lot of trying to understand what it was or what had happened or why it was that our communities were in this way. It took a long time. And, you know, sort of as a teenager, you're kind of thinking, you know, what the heck is going on? Why is this occurring? And it wasn't until I got to that later sort of age when I went through the formal studies where I started to explore, you know, my own culture, my own tribal connections, and why this has happened. And then all those learnings that come from that, the shock, the anger, the, okay, what do I do? All those kind of feelings and emotions that everyone goes through, I'm sure. Yeah. And that's what art has done. It's helped me connect to my culture.
I can relate to that. Thanks for sharing that too. I know that you have a lot of international networks, and I know you've mentioned the digital land mapping. How do those relationships work with people outside Aotearoa?
I feel really privileged to be able to speak to people, especially Indigenous nations globally, because what it's given me is a kind of empowerment just to be outside of this country and see that, many other nations are suffering in the same way, but many other nations are also working towards finding these ways to reconnect and what do we do and land back and all these kind of things that are happening in the movements that are gathering. And it is a growing movement, which I can see because of the work that I'm doing, which then makes me feel more kind of stable within myself when I look at what's happening in our government and things like that. And I'm sort of like, well, no,
That's a firm no.
just no.
it must be heartening to see, the progress that's been made elsewhere, I guess, and that and see. Yeah, I feel like we've made a lot of progress and this is just a blip, hopefully, with the government. Moving back to rematriation, can we talk about the grammar of your piece? Your work is the final piece in the series, and I just was interested in, was there a reason for situating it at the end? It seemed to me to have a gentler, quieter quality than some of the other works. I think the single word that came to me watching your work was steadfast.
I think the reason for putting it at the end was because I know how that karakia was born. I was working with an artist collective looking at the issues with myrtle rust and how do we share that with the public? How do we share it from a Mātauranga Māori perspective? And I had this sort of idea to create this game where kids could move through the forest and sort of see the varieties and the medicinal qualities. So rather than just gaming, they're actually getting a little bit of knowledge of what things are and what they're used for, and then hopefully grow the sort of empathy towards the forest. And in the telling of the game, you understand that you are actually a grandchild of the forest. And so we're all taking care of each other, sort of thing. And I said to my mum, oh, it'd be great if there was a karakia at the beginning of this game where you have to click it, hear the karakia in order to start the gameplay. And I think it's kind of important when we're doing these things, there's that knowledge that's really sacred that shouldn't be shared with everyone. And then there are things that we can share in order to build that relationship. And I knew Mum was the best person to talk to about this. And we were both up in the community Rongoā Forest, where I've kind of been working with the Wellington City Council, sharing my great grandmother's Rongoā recipes through the trees. And she comes bounding out of the forest and she goes, I've got it. The Ngāhere has given me the karakia. Quick. And in the film, you can see she's holding my phone because I really had my camera on me, luckily. And then she's standing there. It's one take, it's as it came out. She's standing in the trees because that's where she said they gave it to her. And so I thought it was a nice little way to finish up because in the karakia, she's sort of asking the Atua and saying how sorry she is that we are in the state we're in and asking for forgiveness. And then speaking to this fungi myrtle rust and saying, you can go back to the earth mother. You can go back to the warmth. I know you're looking for a home, but please leave our trees and head back down to the earth mother. And it was kind of a really nice way of thinking about where we are at the moment and just knowing that no matter who we are or where we are, we can be a part of the earth mother. So, yeah.
Oh, that's beautiful. You've worked with your mum in a few of your films, I think. Is that right? I just wondered about what it's like working with whānau as opposed to somebody who's not from your family. I'm currently working on a project with my sister, and it's the first time I've worked with anyone in my whānau on a creative sort of endeavor, I guess, in my adult life anyway. Yeah, so could you talk a bit about that, working with your mum?
Oh, that's lovely. Yeah, all my artwork has always been about going with my whole whānau, the kids, my mum, and then we get there and we speak to the whenua. And because it's been about putting a camera on the land and letting whatever happens happen. So it's always been about my whole whānau going and doing the thing, because I find when I'm working that if they're not all there, I can't concentrate. And then I can't make the work. It's not the same. I feel a tense feeling. And I know that that's part of our whānau's sort of relationship with Wairuatanga. And that's, everyone's there supporting and you're all in doing the mahi together. So you're all carrying each other. And it's balanced that way rather than it's an individual kind of thing where you're there on your own just doing the thing. Yeah, and I feel like for me, that's part of my process is making sure they're there, we're balanced, because that's the essence of the work that I'm trying to capture is that connection that is unseen, but I'm trying to see it with the lens, the camera. So,
I love that focado. That's
yeah.
I'm gonna remember that. I think it's slightly different for me with as a writer. I sort of, I've got I think I'm coming down to Ōtīpōti in this September for a week's residency, and I'm, hanging out for some quiet solitude time. The 9-year-old, I don't know how old your kids are, but Lenny's 9, and he's very talkative. It's hard to concentrate at times.
Yeah, I don't think I could write with everyone around. That would be
Yeah. I wondered if we could discuss the possibilities there are in moving image for telling Māori stories as
different.
compared to other mediums.
I think there's so many possibilities because with time, I know that when you're observing a film or video, it looks like it's linear, but when you're unfolding a story and creating that story with the video, time can be all sorts of different places or not places, and especially if you look at animated sequences as well, that can be anywhere. So integrating kind of animated and live action, I'm always with the digital work. I'm always trying to see things from a different kind of perspective. That's why I kind of introduce pattern works in my work, to reference the things that aren't being seen. And I think it's for me, video work has always, how am I looking at this in a different way? So it's not entertainment.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, it becomes, sort of thinking about something else that I'm seeing in front of me.
Yes, I
Yeah.
love that. All of the stuff that's seen and maybe not seen as well is something I often think about in my writing, in terms of the point of view, and that linear thing is so interesting, because I thought I'm writing a novel currently, I'm trying to, and I thought that I could just write all these short stories and join them together and have the same characters, and that would make a novel. But in fact, that's linear, and I've realized the novel is, it's a 3D object, and it's not working linear, and I think also from a Maori point of view, it's never linear, right?
That's right. Yeah, time is kind of past, present, future, all in the one space. My grandmother kind of spoke of it like the koru, the punga out there, with its multi spiral kind of pattern work. And that's obvious within our own creative processes. But yeah, that time is past, present, and future, and everything existing in that moment. You can access it. By thinking of the past, you can access it by thinking of the future. It's definitely not linear.
No,
It's, yeah.
linear seems so limited, doesn't it? And kind of alien, and Oh, that's so interesting. It's kind of blown my mind. I guess the point of view is something I'm constantly grappling with in my own writing, which I think about as who knows what and who tells the story or owns the narrative. Was this important in the making of Rematriation? Is point of view a significant factor in moving image, do you think?
I think so, but I don't know if I'm a bit biased when it comes to Indigenous making. I really have an interest in how they're connecting, how they're making the work and connecting to those elements that we all know are there but can't see.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first thing I'm thinking of when I'm looking at Indigenous film works or artworks or creations of any kind. I'm like, ooh, you know, my first option is, can I feel what they're trying to connect to?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then I sort of read back their stories afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm like, oh, you know, and that's when the story kind of opens out more and you're thinking, oh, wow, that's really, and then you go back and you look at it again and you start to see all these little coded sort of moments that are interwoven. And my auntie kind of spoke to us about how that were woven by our ancestors were weaving the stories that are unseen so as they could remain and would come out when they were ready to. And I think this is what's been really amazing about seeing the global changes,
mm-hmm.
is that this information that we thought was lost just comes out in our muko, who mm-hmm. just start talking about these things randomly. And you're like, oh, wow. you know, and you can kind of see what she was saying when they wove those stories into the korowai so as they would remain. And it, you don't feel... Yeah, you don't feel so lost because you think, oh, well, it will come. It will come out.
Sure, yeah. And there's a degree of trust in that, I guess, sort of trusting the process, which I mean, I guess I'm always kind of relating it back to my own work. And I think about when I'm writing, drafting works and sort of writing into the dark, as I call it, and then something will emerge that I didn't even know was the thing that to be uncovered, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Those are the moments I love. I don't know if it's an age thing or something, but I really love not knowing because I feel like that's the moments when you're kind of connecting to those spaces that in between those liminal moments.
Me too. Me too.
It's exciting.
It is. It is exciting. I think it's addictive. That's
yes.
the addictive part of writing for me, possibly. I just wanted to talk about the use of te reo. You know, it's used throughout the program as both a site of knowledge and also something about the orality plays off the different elements of moving image. I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, for me, it's a learning journey I'm still on and know that it's going to be a lifelong journey. I can understand what's being said, but for some reason there's a disconnect. So when I try to communicate back, it's like something's not working, which I know means there's something that I need to unlock with that. So for me, being able to hear those sounds is really important because I think we all need to be hearing those sounds that are echoing across the whenua, you know, or used to, and the way that we used to speak to our grandmother, the earth, and all those children is so important to be able to hear those sounds. And I know that that's also the same globally. Indigenous peoples want to be able to hear the sounds, and a lot of our data knowledge for land is in the songs and the song lines which happen across the landscape. So they mark a mountain by the song. The highs and the low sounds of the song are mountains.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just so important to be able to hear those sounds. Even if I don't understand the sounds from other countries, other communities and things, it's beautiful to listen to because you can start to try and see and feel the landmarks, the maunga, the awa.
Absolutely. Yeah. I really relate to that. And I'm just grateful for all the sort of free, accessible podcasts and things there are, you know, in the last decade or however long, because I still find it doesn't come naturally to speak te reo at home with my little boy. When you haven't grown up into Ao Māori, it's not a natural feeling. So it was beautiful to hear on the screening program on the te reo. Really appreciated it. I guess we've talked a bit about the significance of te taiao in the program. Te Māori wahine a whare tangata, which is a term synonymous with the land. You know, rematriation is all tied up with those ideas. And te taiao is very present in all of the films.
I think what's really important, another thing that I'm discovering is that many of our Indigenous nations were actually matriarchal communities, but not in the kind of reflection of patriarchal communities. It was more along the lines of, you know, this whatever idea of gender is now was very different back then. Mm-hmm. And it was more kind of the jobs that you were doing, and it wasn't really about your gender, but there were more kind of people who were, I guess the word nowadays is non-binary, which would carry the masculine and the feminine. So there was this idea that more of us were both. And I mm-hmm. guess that's where it comes to the word for in Te Reo for is ia, which is he and she.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, and a lot of the kind of the healers were this balance, because that's what's so important in our language and our knowledge systems is this idea of balance. And that's why for Māori, you know, it's the water, the whakawātea balancing when you've been walking in te ao wairua and doing that mahi, you know, there's this idea that you have to rebalance yourself. And so I think for rematriation, it's this idea of just bringing a balance. So not seeking control,
mm-hmm.
you know, not putting control over everyone and everything with femininity. It's just this idea of bringing a kind of balance back.
I love that.
Yes.
Yeah, I just feel like historically we weren't defined by or sort of limited by gender or put, you know, we didn't have categories of female and male, you know. I love that idea of balance. And, yeah, I feel like it really resonates with the program, you know. Yeah, I think of balance when I think of watching those films. Thank you so much. E mihi ana ki a koe e hoa. I've really enjoyed our kōrero today, and I'm so grateful to you for giving up your precious time and speaking with me today. So.
Oh, no, thank you. Thank you for all your wonderful questions and the conversations. I'm looking forward to hearing the rest of them.
Thanks so much. Ka kite.
Rematriation screens at the Arts Centre Ototahi from the 2nd to 31st of May and the upcoming Wairoa Māori Film Festival. If you're interested in showing the program at your venue, please contact Circuit. And listen out for part two of our Rematriation pod series, where we interview Sandy Wakefield. Kia ora.